This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
You know, I think it'd be interesting just to really try to unravel what his ties
are. There's a sort of country-city divide. They're inconvenient, and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
My nerves, I guess.
Hi, David.
How are you?
Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Congrats on the book.
Few books this year have been as anticipated as What Happened. It's Hillary Clinton's account of the presidential election that she lost to Donald Trump, why she lost it, and what's happening in the country in the years since. It's angry, it's accusatory, and apologetic at the same time. The book was published last week, and I met with Clinton at her office in Manhattan.
You gave an incredibly moving concession speech, a speech the morning after the election. And you said, we must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and a chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. We don't just respect that, we cherish it. Masha Gessen, who wrote in favor of you throughout the campaign and in many ways, said, you should have said something else. You should have said, we have lost, and this is maybe the last day of my political career, so I will say what must be said. We're standing at the edge of an abyss. Our political system, our society, our country are at greater danger than at any time in the last century and a half. The president-elect has made his intentions clear, and it would be immoral to pretend otherwise. You know where this is going. Are we at the point where you're ready to say that? Are we in the dire straits that Masha Gessen is asking you to describe?
Well, I think the president and his administration pose a clear and present danger to our democracy. And I hoped back the day after that election that I wouldn't be sitting here all these months later feeling compelled to say that with a sense of urgency, but I am and I do. I am deeply concerned about the direction he is taking our country and his behavior in office, which I think is way beyond politics as usual.
Clear and present danger is a very specific, constitutionally rooted phrase. What do you mean by it in its specificity? What concerns you the most?
Really, several things. And I write about all of these in the book. But first, the ongoing assault on facts, reason, truth, which is insidious and deeply antithetical to a democracy. I think the attack by Russia, which we still don't fully understand, was a new form of warfare, and I write in some detail about that.
You use the word war, in
Yes,
fact.
I do. And it was right out of the playbook of Putin and one of the generals who he listens to. This attack on our electoral system, which was at least publicly encouraged by Trump and his campaign, I hope the investigations in the Congress by Mueller as well will give us more information and understanding of what else they really did to us, is not going away. And as you know so well, Putin wants to undermine democracy, to undermine the Atlantic Alliance, to undermine the EU, to undermine NATO, and to reassert Russian influence as much as possible beyond the borders. So the stakes are huge here.
The stakes were huge all along, and the stakes could never have been more gigantic toward the end of the campaign, and the Obama administration had a very tough decision to make.
Mm-hmm.
You write in your book that you put it in a very speculative way. I sometimes wonder if the president had gone on television and made this a more pronounced thing. In other words, there was a choice to make for the president, President Obama. Either treat it as a very like a political hand grenade, knowing that if he came out publicly, he would be accused of tipping the scales toward you, or you treat it like a national security emergency, and the hell with the campaign, and you do what's necessary. Now, you have been very politic on this. Most people on the Obama side have been pretty politic on this, saying, well, it was very hard to know, and we thought she would win. One person in the administration, at least, said, we blew it. Quoted in the Washington Post. Did President Obama blow it?
Well, I think that I'm very understanding of the position he found himself in because I've been in that situation room. I know how hard these calls can be. And I believe that they struggled with this and they were facing some pretty difficult headwinds. Let me just mention a couple. Mitch McConnell, in what I think of as a not only unpatriotic, but despicable act of partisan politics, made it clear that if the Obama administration spoke publicly about what they knew, he would accuse them of partisan politics, of trying to tip the balance toward me, even though, as you point out, the president thought I was going to win, thought that all the way up until the night before the election when he told me that. So that was one.
He told you the night before the election that he was pretty sure you were going to win.
Absolutely. He said, you've got this. I'm so proud of you. And he was running his own research, his own analytics.
Because you remember, I traveled with him to North Carolina just before, and I said, are you feeling confident? He said, nope.
You never do. You never feel confident. I mean, you just
can't.
You don't
allow yourself to.
You don't allow yourself. You have to fight to the very end. So I think that the role that McConnell played, the role that Comey played in refusing to in any way acknowledge there was an investigation, made the political stakes even higher for the president.
Nevertheless. Did he blow it?
Nevertheless, I would have, in retrospect now, wished that he had said something because I think the American people deserved to know.
Does he wish he had said something?
I don't know. I think it's something he's probably mulling over, but I have not spoken to him about that.
Let's go to October 7th, the most bizarre day that I can think of in American politics. It begins with statements about Russian activities. Then it's followed about minutes later by the Access Hollywood tape. And I've talked to people around you who say everybody out in the world thought the Access Hollywood tape would be the greatest gift to the Clinton campaign ever. We were freaking out because it was going to obscure the Russia thing. Because the people that were going to be most offended by Access Hollywood were already voting for you.
Yeah. Well, but you forgot the other thing that happened.
And later in the day,
right,
the email dropped.
Within an hour, the email dropped. So it seems clear to us that the Russians were again being guided about our politics.
Guided is the word you
use. Yes, I would say guided.
And that means what?
Someone was offering very astute political advice about how to weaponize information, how to convey it, how to use the existing Russian outlets like RT or Sputnik, how to use existing American vehicles like Facebook. They were given very astute advice. So what my analysis led me to conclude is that the Access Hollywood tape was like a big bomb going off. And it just blotted out everything for about 48, maybe 72 hours.
Because it was irresistibly obscene.
It was obscene. It was him. He was on tape. He was confessing or bragging about sexual assault. He said he could get away with anything. I mean, everything that we had tried to tell people about him was there for the world to see. Now, because there was no follow-up story, and because the press said, okay, we've covered that, and there's nothing else to cover, became obsessed with the details of John Podesta's emails, including his risotto recipe, that became the drumbeat. But every single day from then on, artfully done, WikiLeaks was dropping emails.
And what was their ideological motivation to be behind Trump, in your view? Why would Julian Assange be in favor of Trump in a sense of nihilist, let's all just blow it up? I mean, what's the motivation there? We just published a huge profile of him, and he remains a pretty mysterious character.
I don't think he is that mysterious. I think he is part nihilist, part anarchist, part exhibitionist, part opportunist, who is either actually on the payroll of the Kremlin or in some way supporting their propaganda objectives because of his resentment toward the United States, toward Europe. He's like a lot of the voices that we're hearing now, which are expressing appreciation for the macho authoritarianism of a Putin. And they claim to be acting in furtherance of transparency, except they never go after the Kremlin or people on that side of the political ledger.
Do you put him in the same basket as Snowden?
I do. I think that both Snowden—
And Chelsea Manning?
That's a different case. I mean, I think there's a different set of motivations and, from my understanding of the case, manipulation that led to her actions. But with Snowden and Assange, I do put them in the same bucket, and they both end up serving the strategic goals of—
You think Snowden willingly is serving the strategic goals of—
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I think that it isn't an accident he ended up in Russia, and it's not an accident that Assange ended up serving as the vehicle for disclosing and distributing the emails that were stolen first from the DNC and then from Podesta. But the point here is they not only dropped them into the middle of our presidential campaign a month before the election, they weaponized them. Mm-hmm.
Suggesting
some level of either guidance, cooperation between political actors and WikiLeaks and the Russians. And if you look at how Trump used WikiLeaks, we counted up that he mentioned WikiLeaks 160 times that last month.
I love WikiLeaks.
I love WikiLeaks. You know, he had in the summer called on the Russians to go find my personal emails. And so he was keeping that drumbeat going, and then innocuous comments in the emails were transformed into attacks. And if you just read the WikiLeaks, as we quote Tom Friedman, he said, you know, I like Wiki Hillary. I think she'd be a good president. Mm. But if you read on Facebook or Twitter or in InfoWars about John and I running a child trafficking ring in a pizza—
I didn't know you ran that.
Yeah, we didn't either. And the Clinton Foundation, you know, turning its money over to us and paying for our daughter's wedding. People believed that. Access Hollywood happens, big bomb, and then it fades away. WikiLeaks just kept going. More and more Google searches for WikiLeaks. People trying to get behind the curtain, so to speak. What's really happening?
Then so in political terms, though, who do you lose as a result of WikiLeaks?
We lose people trying to make up their minds.
Is there a suburban woman outside of Philadelphia who liked you after Access Hollywood but didn't after WikiLeaks? How do you quantify this?
Well, if you're talking specifically about WikiLeaks, we have one example, which we use, of Glenn Kessler, as you know, from the Washington Post, saying that people voted for Trump because the Clinton Foundation paid for Chelsea's wedding. These were people who at least were open to me.
Graspable.
But whose opinion closed dramatically against me. And then the Comey letter hits. And that's when the bottom fell out, particularly with women in the suburbs of Philadelphia and elsewhere, who thought, well, you know, that's it. I wanted to vote for her. I was fighting with my husband, with my son, with my employer, and I told them I was going to vote for her. But they're right. She's going to jail. We're going to lock her up. I can't vote for her.
Or what the hell? Let's blow it up.
That was not women. Women are not into blowing it up. There were a lot of white male voters whose anger, resentment, grievance wanted to blow it up. And they were very receptive to Trump's argument. So you get the Comey effect. And it's similar to what happened with Access Hollywood. The Comey effect of the letter blanketed the media. I went from, I think, 26 points ahead in the suburbs of Philadelphia to 13 points ahead. You say, oh, well, you're still ahead. I needed to win by about 18
to cover Western
Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania. The Comey letter blanketed the traditional media. The Google searches kept going on WikiLeaks. Oh, my gosh. Was she involved in some criminality in a pizza parlor? Let's find out. So it was the perfect storm. It was the perfect storm.
The whole thing was the perfect storm.
It was. It was. And not to make any excuses, because I try not to, and I try to take responsibility for everything that I did that hurt me. But the combination of these factors really was unprecedented.
One factor we haven't discussed, I remember, you won't remember, but 25 years ago or so, whatever it was, 1993, whatever that is, I was invited to the White House, and I got to sit next to you at a dinner. There were a series of kind of smallish, by White House standards, dinners, and a piece in the New York Times had just been published by Michael Kelly, Saint Hillary, attacking the politics of virtue and all this, and you were not happy about that article.
Right.
And it seemed to me that that period began a relationship with the press that was difficult, to say the very least. And it might surprise some people who haven't read the book yet, one of the objects of your criticism and even anger in this book is not Breitbart, not the Drudge Report, but the New York Times.
Well, let me say more generally, I have a lot of sympathy for what the press was facing in this election, because it was a perfect storm. It was hard to know how to cover someone who played for the cameras all the time, who said outrageous and vile things, whose record was incredibly negative when it comes to any kind of honesty in business or his attitudes about race and so much more. And it's hard to cover that. I understand that.
Nevertheless, the truest thing that Donald Trump ever said is, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and nobody would say a thing about it. There was story after story after story about his business dealings, his child, all of this stuff.
But if you look at the overall news coverage, David, which I'm sure you have and which we cover in the book, I got much more negative press than he did.
And tell me why you think this is. You speculate here and there in the book, but never quite come down to it. It's very painful in the book. You describe it. You have to come to the conclusion that you're held out for some sort of special treatment and that millions of people don't like you for one reason or another. How do you go about analyzing that?
Well, let's
Do you
take,
feel like a victim in this?
No, I don't feel like a victim, but let's take that statement. When I left the State Department, I had a 69% approval rating.
Because you were running something.
I was running something in service to someone else, a man, who I was honored to serve. And so I knew that if I did get into the presidential race again, I would face what women face. When you are not serving someone, but you are seeking power yourself.
So what you're saying is that it's gendered, as we now say, and not Clinton-specific.
No, I think it was Clinton-specific plus sexism and misogyny. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the way the press, which thought I was going to win and which gave me lavish endorsements. I got endorsements from papers that had never endorsed a Democrat before, certainly not since, you know, World War II. And the endorsements all said, like the Times endorsement said, you know, this email thing, it's like an issue for the help desk. So smart, thoughtful, experienced journalists, when writing about what they believed was best for the country in this election, lauded me. But when it came to news, because I think in part they couldn't figure out how to cover Trump. And because, yes, the Russians served up stuff, which was irresistible. Mm-hmm. Comey served up stuff, which they couldn't say no to. There was such an imbalance. And the imbalance, which, you know, scholars are now writing about, that basically concluded that I talked about jobs more than anything else. Network news covered all policies to the tune of 32 minutes during the whole campaign, as compared to 114 minutes in 2012 and 220 minutes in 2008. So I took the responsibility of trying to tell people what I would do and how I would pay for it very seriously, because I really believed that at some point it would count.
Hillary Clinton, former senator, former secretary of state, and the Democratic nominee for president in the 2016 election. We'll talk more in a moment about how to address the nuclear threat of North Korea. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier this month, I met with Hillary Clinton at her office just before her book, What Happened, was officially published. And I spoke with her about how she lost the most astonishing presidential campaign of our lifetimes and the threats at home and abroad that America now faces.
Back in the day, you got blasted for using the phrase vast right-wing conspiracy, although what you described, the map of it, is pretty undeniable. Then you got blasted for using the phrase deplorable, basket of deplorables. Are there deplorables in this country, and how many?
I think Trump has behaved in a deplorable manner, both during the campaign and as president. I think he has given permission to others to engage in deplorable behavior, as we did see in Charlottesville and elsewhere. So I don't take back the description that I made of him and a number of his core supporters. And it's deeply disturbing to me, and that's part of the clear and present danger, that these groups of people are trying to assert their views as a way of marginalizing and dismissing so many other Americans. And I don't think that's, you know, in our interests. His inaugural speech was a cry from the white nationalist gut. It wasn't in any way a speech of reconciliation, of outreach. He is still playing to that base. That is part of what he's doing by trying to turn the clock back on the Dreamers and the DACA protection that they got.
I've lived in New York for a long time, as have you. Donald Trump was a kind of figure on the New York jokescape. He was a cover of Spy magazine figure. He wasn't even a leading light in the real estate business here. And suddenly, really quite suddenly, he went from that to this. And you campaigned against him for a long time. You've thought about him endlessly. You debated him 3 times with him looming over your back, which we can talk about in a second. But I want to know what you make of him as a human being.
I think he is immature, with poor impulse control, unqualified for the position that he holds, reactive, not proactive, not strategic, and I think he is unpredictable, which makes him dangerous. The latest incident with North Korea, going after our ally, South Korea, while North Korea is threatening the region, threatening us, going after China, which we need, whether we like it or not, to help us try to resolve the aggressive behavior of Kim Jong-un, it puts a smile on Kim's face, just like him going after NATO and the Atlantic Alliance puts a smile on Putin's face. He admires authoritarians. In fact, before this crisis with North Korea, he was praising Kim Jong-un. He clearly has a bromance toward Putin, and he's being played. He's being played by the Putins and the Kim Jong-uns of the world. I'm not even sure he's aware of that because he has such a limited understanding of the world. Everything is in relation to how it makes him feel. And therefore, he has little objective distance, which a leader must have. Making decisions in the Oval Office requires a level of dispassionate, reasoned analysis. We've seen no evidence he's capable of that.
What is the proper policy to carry out vis-a-vis North Korea at this moment? This is a really perilous moment.
Yes, it is. Well, it's hard to talk about what needs to be done because it has to be both a diplomatic and a military approach. There are no diplomats at home. There are no China experts. I don't know who is left in the government at any level of experience and seniority who could be brought in to the kind of diplomatic effort that I would advocate for. You should have an envoy that carries the imprimatur of the president in Korea right now, shuttling between Tokyo and Seoul and Beijing, and making it clear to China in particular that we cannot stand back and allow an attack on South Korea or Japan or, heaven forbid, Hawaii. We would have to respond. North Korea shooting a missile over Tokyo that caused sirens to go off is going to be the biggest argument for Abe and his party to remilitarize and rearm. South Korea doesn't want that, and China doesn't want that. But what's the alternative? So I think intense diplomacy right now would make a difference. We have basically outsourced that to the military. You know, Mattis is both Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, as far as I can tell. he's a general, and I have the greatest respect for him. I was in Fallujah with him shortly after the Marines took it back.
We have generals running foreign policy.
We have generals, and there's a very important role for generals, and there's a very important military aspect to any kind of coercive diplomacy, but it can't be the leading edge. And I worry that nobody's home at the State Department, and there isn't anybody to really guide a strategic approach to North Korea as opposed to tweeting and, you know, speechifying.
This is not in the book, though you do use the phrase, wonderful phrase, man-spreading, a New York subway expression that Putin's posture toward almost everyone is one of contempt. But I've also heard that in meetings with you, he would not even look at you at times and stare away. What was the dynamic between the two of you in a room? How did he treat you?
It was interesting because he would man-spread. He would make very belligerent comments to the press spray.
With you sitting next to him?
With me sitting next to him. We were the one incident I'm thinking about, we were in his dacha outside of Moscow. Then the press would leave the room, and he would just not look at me. He would just basically sit there. So I would come with my agenda, and I would have our ambassador and, you know, maybe one other person, and he would have one or two people. So I would raise all these issues, which he would give short shrift to, you know, flick of his hand, a contemptuous, disdainful look. And so I always came to meetings prepared to say something that might catch his interest. So in that particular meeting, I said, you know, one thing we do have in common, Mr. President, is a great interest in wildlife conservation. And all of a sudden he sits up and he actually looks at me. I said, I've studied what you're doing with Siberian tigers, with polar bears, and I want to commend you because that's a very important issue for you to lead on. He looks at me and he says, come with me. He gets up. I get up. I follow him out the door. We go down the stairs. We go down a corridor. We go into a little office. All of his security is sitting there. They jump up. And he opens a door. We go into an ante room. Then we go into a big room that looks kind of like a giant situation room with a very large desk and the biggest map of Russia you've ever seen on the wall. It's sort of the inner sanctum of the dacha. And he begins telling me what he's doing in Siberia and Franz Josef Island. And then he turns to me and he goes, I'm going to the island to tag polar bears. He says to me, would Bill like to come? I said, well, I don't know. I'll ask him, Mr. President. But if he can, I'd be happy to come. Doesn't respond to that. But we had the most animated.
He didn't think you were the polar bear type.
No. Wrong.
Gender.
But we had the most animated conversation and it really worked to make some kind of connection with him. Fast forward, the last time I met with him was in Vladivostok in September, Labor Day, of 2012. And we were in a pitched battle with Russia over Syria. And he wouldn't meet with me. He wouldn't talk to me because he knew I was going to raise Syria again. And as you probably know, I had been one who said we needed to do more earlier.
You wanted a no-fly zone and other.
Yeah, and to support the original rebels, not the, you know, ISIS, al-Nusra rebels. So finally, right before the dinner, we have all the meetings. She won't give me the time of day. Right before the dinner, we have like a 10-minute sit-down. And he's, you know, looking bored and uninvolved. But protocol required that I sat next to him at dinner.
How's his English?
It's okay.
Yeah, it's
better than people know. So he was not enthusiastic about it, but you know what they say, you know, what's the difference between a protocol officer and a terrorist? You can negotiate with a terrorist. So we had hosted it the year before. Indonesia was hosting it the next year. So he had to sit between me and the president of Indonesia. So again, I came prepared with something to talk about. So
these
I said,
are
you
like
know,
bad dates.
It is a little bit like that. And, you know, you have your little repertoire of conversation subjects. So I said to him, "Oh, Mr. President, before I came here, I stopped in St. Petersburg and I went to the memorial to the siege of Leningrad." And all of a sudden he perks up and he says, "What did you think?" And I told him, how moving it was and how extraordinary a story of courage and persistence and resilience of the Russian people. And he says, "Let me tell you something." And he proceeds to tell me a story that no Russian expert that I've ever told this to had ever heard before. And he says his father had been on the front lines, and he was manning the front lines for days, and then they got a little time off. He was going back to, you know, just collapse, spend the night in his apartment with his wife. He gets to his street. He's walking down his street. He sees the body collectors who are trying to lift up the dead bodies as quickly as possible to prevent, you know, plague and other disease. He walks by the pile of bodies, and he sees a leg sticking out. And he says, "That's my wife. That's my wife." He recognized the leg and the shoe. And he begins pulling on the leg, and the body collectors are yelling at him, "Get out of there, get out of there." He says, "I won't leave my wife, I won't leave my wife." He pulls her out of the pile, carries her up to the apartment, and she's still alive. He nurses her back to health. A few years after the war, Putin is born. So Putin tells me this story. Immediately after the dinner, I get Mike McFaul and the, you know, the CIA guys and everybody
together. Mike McFaul's the ambassador, yeah.
Yeah. The ambassador, and a Russian expert, and I tell them the story, and they just look at me wide-eyed, because it's kind of like Masha Gessen's book, The Man with No Face. Nobody really knows anything about him. So I guess my larger point is that he can be engaged if you really work at it, but he never forgets what his objectives are. And in the book, I have one of his favorite quotes from Lenin. You take a bayonet and you push. If you hit mush, you keep going. If you hit steel, you stop. He is someone that has to be managed every single day to be able to make clear to him that there are limits. And of course, circling back to this election, he succeeded in affecting our election.
Were we mush?
I think we were mushy. And what I fear is we still haven't gotten to the bottom of what the Russians did. That's why I am strongly in favor of an independent commission with subpoena powers to really go deep into understanding what they did. And especially with this new information coming out about their intrusion into voting rolls, their potential interference with election officials' personal accounts. What were they doing, and what effect did it have?
Fair enough. Do you think that a Republican Congress is capable of turning on Donald Trump if there's a certain evidentiary weight? How does this end, or does it end?
Well, we're going to have to wait to see what the investigations turn up. But on this point about investigating what Russia has done, the Republicans have just as big a stake in this as Democrats. Putin can turn on Republicans and members of Congress. Putin can turn on Trump. Putin can not only try to influence elections in 2018, but in 2020. And all bets are off. Trump has turned out to be a disappointment in some respects because the sanctions are still in effect, and he felt compelled to sign the congressional legislation on sanctions. But no one should rest easy. Just because it was aimed at me, because I represented the United States and spoke out and stood up to him, doesn't mean it ends with me.
Before I came over here this morning, I went on to Twitter and I punched in your name.
A dangerous thing to do,
David.
No,
it's a horrendous thing to do. And you would think that you were president and that you had just made the most divisive decision possible and the most emotional. It never stops where you're concerned.
Well, but I've thought a lot about this. And for whatever combination of reasons, some I think I understand, others I don't, I am viewed as a threat to powerful forces on both the right and the left. I am still one of the favorite subjects for Fox TV. And it's because I do speak out and I do stand up. And sometimes, you know, what I say is not fully appreciated for years, to be honest. At least it seems to me that way. And on the left, there is a real manipulation of the left. In addition to those who are calling me names, we know that Russia has really targeted, through their trolls and bots, a lot of accounts, Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts, of people on the left, feeding them a steady diet of just
nonsense. But it wasn't
nonsense.
Just that. It was Bernie Sanders was hammering at you for months. And
yes, he was.
You were very reluctant, and I think your advisors were reluctant, mm-hmm. join you in this reluctance, and President Obama, too, mm-hmm. for you to hammer back.
Right.
Because he was in your own party.
Right.
Was that a mistake?
Hard to know. I mean, I beat him by 4 million votes. That was a landslide. But he never...
Did he play fair with you?
Oh, I think he is not a Democrat. And that's not a smear. That's what he says about himself. And he riled up so many people who supported him with all kinds of innuendo and artful smear about me that he was reluctant to do for me what I had done for President Obama.
You resent him for that?
No, I don't have any personal feelings about it one way or the other. I am interested in fielding candidates at all levels who can win. That's why I've started this group called Onward Together to help recruit, train, and support people who will run, particularly young people and especially young women. And so I'm looking for that bench and that next generation of Democratic leaders who will bring their own sensibility and experiences into politics, which I think would be all to the good.
Secretary Clinton, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Hillary Rodham Clinton. I wrote a profile of Clinton for The New Yorker, and you can find that at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining me. Since the inauguration in January of Donald Trump, there's been a kind of protest renaissance in the country, with people on the left and some in the center of American politics dusting off the tactics, the chants, and the songs that became symbols of resistance during the civil rights and Vietnam eras. But a lot of the people doing the protesting today weren't around in the 60s, not by a long shot. And it's by and large a young person's game. And social media has changed what it even means to protest, whether all the singing and chanting is even necessary anymore. The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham talked to two young people who were involved in a concert performance put on by the theater company called The Team that tried to get at that generational divide.
I mean, I sometimes wonder about people who are teenagers now because in some ways they might be better suited to deal with the particular chaos of the moment than any of the rest of us. But the only view that we get really of people at this point significantly younger than myself are young people on college campuses. reacting to whoever the latest campus speaker is. And that, I think, is a very unfair reduction of what the real energy there is. It certainly can't just be that. Primer for a failed superpower is really sort of a simple idea. It's a group of people singing protest songs. The complexity comes in two ways. One, what is a protest song? So I never thought of Smells Like Teen Spirit as a protest song. It's one of the songs in the concert. And the other feature is that these songs are being sung by people who fall into three large age categories. First are baby boomers, older people, a bridge generation, as they called it, of 30-something people, and a younger group, which they're calling teens. I visited a rehearsal for Primer because it seemed to be an exercise that would really illuminate the differences, but also hopefully some of the similarities between generations.
I thought my whole life that I was a millennial, genuinely, and I've been like broadcasting, oh yeah, I'm a millennial, we're gonna change the world. But I found out that like I didn't meet the cutoff because I was born in 99, so I'm a part of Generation Z.
I mean, millennial was like originally coined to mean somebody who's going to come of age after the new millennium.
Right.
And like, I will come of age after the new millennium because I was born to, like, the after the new millennium.
So I invited two of the teenagers that I met at this rehearsal, Maxwell Weiss and Logan Rozos, to just talk to me about how it had been to learn these songs alongside so many other politically minded people, but of these different ages. And are you guys both in high school?
Oh, I just graduated, thank God.
Just graduated.
I'm going to be a junior in the fall.
Going to be a junior. What was your involvement with protest before the show?
Oh, you want me to go first? Okay. My parents, like, took me to a lot of marches as a kid. I went to the Women's March. Probably the first, like, big piece of theater I did was an experimental opera about boycotting meat in the early 1900s. and my grandfather was a union delegate to the teachers' union. Mm-hmm. And I never met him, but, like, my family knew that unions and, like, labor was really important.
Just being an activist was kind of always in my life. Like, I remember in middle school, I did a small protest because they wouldn't let boys wear nail polish.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, like, a walkout in my class.
And so I wonder, sort of, just as a matter of your generation, right? Like, so much political speech, so much political thought gets done online. I wonder how you guys feel about traditional protest, whether for your generation, it makes as much sense as the other ways of communicating, like, you know, just the
Facebook
sort of
status.
Yeah, exactly right. Instead of outside with a picket sign, is there a way, does that feel old or anachronistic to you? Or
I think currently activism and being woke is trendy. So right now everybody wants to be politically engaged, not because they think it's right, but because they think it's popular. But when I met Primer, I started talking to the baby boomers and the millennials about their type of protest. And I remember, one of them told me that nothing gets done by sitting down in your room. You have to go out. You need to gather as a community and visually be there.
Mm.
But at the same time, I'm not sure how prominent of a role marching and, like, picketing will have in the future of activism. I do think it's important to meet with people who share a common goal. But I think that, like, we have so many new tools that have emerged since the civil rights movement that, like, we shouldn't necessarily be using civil rights movement era tactics to achieve our political demands.
I know the one thing we did right was the day we started to fight. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
Most of the music in the show I was never exposed to, just because I grew up in Bushwick. So, mm-hmm. like, the music I knew was, like, Wu-Tang Clan, TLC, Biggie, or, like, Chicken Noodle Soup, Soulja Boy. Like, they legit taught us Chicken Noodle Soup in my school for my graduation song. I cannot lie Amazing. About that. But then I think with this show, I remember with this show specifically with music, I asked all the older generations, like, can you tell me an album that I must go home and listen to? Mm-hmm. I remember one of our castmates, Jake, told me about this cover of Smelled Like Teen Spirit by Patti Smith.
Okay.
I have so much great music now that I really wish I would have listened to as a kid. It would have probably made me a lot stronger.
Yeah, I got introduced to so much new music and also like reintroduced to music from my childhood. Like my dad is a huge Stevie Wonder fan, but like when we did Village Ghetto Land, I was like, oh. Because it doesn't protest against a particular issue.
Right.
Like people might not see it as a protest song. They might see it as a personal song. But like I think in recent years, more and more, the personal and political have been indistinguishable from each other. And yeah. like Jake talked about like how our generation and his generation's protest music doesn't know what it's protesting because there's this idea that everything is so messed up, including right. ourselves, and we can't avoid being part of the problem. So like how do you pick one thing to fight against?
First of all, I was so excited about this because I love Village Ghetto Land. I'm like also like a big Stevie Wonder fan. I love it. Talk to me about, because there was Village Ghetto Land in there. There's What a Wonderful World, which is such an interesting mm-hmm. contrast.
Brilliant.
There.
It was a pretty explicit dialogue between the teens singing Village Ghetto Land and the 30-somethings and the baby boomers singing Wonderful World. Like, we've known nothing else but, like, crushing poverty, and we live in this, like, awful ghetto, like, look at us. And the adults being like, it's anyway, fine. Look at that rose.
Yeah, like, look at how beautiful life
so
is.
It's so pretty.
Why are you upset?
Did that sort of, some of those things echo what you saw in the actual dynamics between the generations, like about them being blind to the problems of young people? Did you feel that?
Not to any, like, significant extent, yeah. but a couple times, like, it's just not possible for us to fully understand each other because so much new vocabulary has been established, especially yeah. surrounding, like, LGBT issues.
Yes, I think of, like, pronouns. A lot of the older cast members never really understood the fact that there's non-binary people because it wasn't a privilege that they have.
The younger cast, I feel like they've had so many, like, experiences of, like, things already changing and like,
by,
getting
by
better.
By younger cast, you mean the people, like, the literal children I met.
The
that
literal
were, like,
children.
Like,
there's
eighth graders.
Right? Yeah. Maya's 13, Zyda's 14,
Zyda's 14, Gigi's 12, Zach is 13.
Wow. And I remember, like, coming out was such a hard thing when I was talking to Gigi, and then Gigi said, you know, you didn't have to come out. You never developed into being gay. You were born gay. She was like, when you tell people that you're gay, you're just giving them the power to approve you. If you approve yourself, then who cares? And I remember, like, Gigi telling me that. And then,
that's
like,
wild.
An hour later, she told me that she was 12. And I remember at 12 years old, I was having just such a hard time understanding what gay
work.
Was.
Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell.
I'm a lot more knowledgeable and politically engaged than I was before the show. And before the show, I thought I was, like, extremely engaged. But after meeting all these people with all these different stories and all these different pains and accomplishments, problems and solutions, there's different spectrums of protests and different variations and different levels. Like, saying a trigger warning or giving pronouns is a type of protest because you're enforcing an idea that you want to be inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, I'm probably going to grapple for, like, my whole life about the most effective way to bring about political change. And, like, I'm not going to write off checking in somewhere on Facebook, and I'm not going to write off marching in the streets, and I'm not going to write off, like, weird experimental operas about meat strikes. I think that there's so many different ways to do things. And
there's no, like, one certain
there's
way
no,
to protest.
There's no, like, perfect way to protest. Like, it's not, like, either you live
important.
Up to this ideal or mm-hmm. you're just wasting your time.
Yeah.
Like Gen Xers, one thing that someone pointed out to me that I hadn't realized before is they love to take notes.
Like, they do. That's the, all they did was
the
take
day
notes.
When we
they had like a whole pad full of notes.
Yeah.
I feel so triggered right now. I know exactly what you're talking about.
The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham spoke with performers Maxwell Weiss and Logan Rozos, who were in Primer for a Failed Superpower last month. Now, I know you weren't counting, at least I hope you weren't, but this is episode number 100 of the New Yorker Radio Hour, a little milestone for us. And over the last 2 years, I've introduced you to many of the people who make The New Yorker tick, the writers and cartoonists, and my colleagues on the editorial staff who are the heart and soul of the magazine. But the radio show comes to you every week because of so many more people than we ever have time to put in the credits. So if you'll indulge me for a minute, it's a special occasion after all, I'd like to call out a few of them. I have to start with Pamela McCarthy.
Hello.
The deputy editor and sort of the fairy godmother of the Radio Hour, and Dean Capello.
I want you to have options.
The godfather.
So.
Though not in the Marlon Brando sense.
Hi there.
Here at One World Trade Center, the ever vigilant Fabio Bertoni.
Hello.
Well, hello, Radio Hour.
Peter Canby and the whole amazingly hardworking crew of fact checkers.
We're on the record.
You're always on the record unless they say.
Mike Luo and David Rode. Wei Chu, Susanna Kempel, and Nathan Burstein.
Happy 100th episode, New Yorker Radio Hour.
Natalie Raby, Erica Hinsley, and Adria Piazza.
Hey.
Deanna Donegan, and many of her illustrators, especially Rebecca Mock and Richie Pope. Bruce Dionne.
What are you doing?
Cassandra DaCosta, Rhonda Sherman, and the New Yorker Festival crew, Risa Leibowitz, and Lisa Hughes, the publisher of The New Yorker.
Just like, hi.
Now, a mile north of where I'm sitting at WNYC is Melissa O'Donnell.
Hi.
The infinitely diligent Sarah Sandbach.
Hi.
Michael L. Sesser.
Did I go too late?
Melissa LaCase and Alicia Allen. Hal Trencher and his team in sponsorship. Peter Weingart and Mandy Naglich and Yuri Kim.
Oh my God, are you actually?
Valentina Powers.
Yeah,
Aaron Cohen. Technical guru is Rob Christensen. Greg Gasparino and David Satkowski. Jennifer Houlihan Roussel and David Catrone, Theodore Kuzlin and Robin Billenkoff, Michelle Rusnick and Michelle Halliburton, and Edward O'Connor, John Chow,
hello,
and Laura Walker.
Hello, New Yorkers.
The president of New York Public Radio. If it takes a village to make a radio program, I'm paraphrasing, this is a very special radio program, and it takes two villages. I'm grateful to everyone who helps us to do this thing every week, and most of all to you for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrato. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.